Hello and good morning from the very top of the Conor Pass, the jewel in the crown of Ireland's newest national park, Park na Síonta na Mara Círi. It's very peaceful here right now, but this is a deceptively busy, even contested landscape, because as I look north, on either side of the Owen Moore River in the valley below me, there is forestry, there is sheep, there is cattle. On the road beside me here, in a short while, there will be cars streaming down the hill into Dangany Cúis Dingle. 2 million tourist visitors to that really tiny town a year. Also in Dangany Cúis Harbour is a fisheries fleet wondering what does this national park mean for them. Because everywhere you look, there are as many different ideas of what a national park could be or should be as there are people asking that question. So that's what we're going to look at on this morning's programme. What is a national park for?
Will I tie this up again now?
A few weeks ago, sheep farmer Brendan Greeny woke up to find that he had a new neighbour, and they hadn't introduced themselves before moving in.
Oh, that's the national park. Top of the Conor Pass is behind there. You can see the cars already gathered. And it goes from, you can see the difference in the vegetation and the distance. You can see where there's a bit of heather, and then it's kind of eaten more with sheep on the other side. Mm-hmm. And it goes all the way over as far as takes in the forestry.
This is the 1,400 acres that was sold, you mean? That takes
correct,
in that forestry.
Correct, and the Owen Moore River as well.
So does this mean that you almost literally or actually do share a fence with the new national park?
With part of it, yeah. With some of it further over, yeah, I share a fence with it, you know. So I'm not sure whether people would be farming here in years to come.
These are crosses, Brendan. What kind of a mixture are they?
That one there is a Charlie father, and what would be known as the Dingle Scotch mother, and the other one is the Texel and the Hill Tex. The Hill Tex is a cross between a Texel and a Scotch. First of all, you'll get a more marketable lamb, a more saleable lamb. You've got a better quality lamb compared to the pure mountain Dingle Scotch. I'd rarely keep, I might keep some of them that would be a cross, but I'd rarely keep a three-quarter bred or a pure bred because the land is not good enough.
They wouldn't winter well, would they?
No, they wouldn't. You'd have to feed them a lot more and mind them, and that's work. Even though the Scotch, I think myself, the Scotch is, now some people don't feed them, but they're gone a bit soft, mollycoddle there, you know. But every farmer is bringing in inputs into their farm. There's very few farmers that can produce enough of food on their farm to feed all their flock 24/7, 365.
Okay. Is this a livelihood for you, or do you have to have some kind of an off-farm income?
Well, I'm retired myself, so I probably am not a good example, but I have. You would not survive on this, you know. But
not retired as a farmer, retired as
a teacher.
So you have a state pension.
I have, yes. So without that,
this wouldn't make sense. No,
it would be beans and toast every day.
God.
There was always sheep here, I suppose, and I was involved to a point for many years. But again, you ask yourself the question. In September, will I go again? You know, in other words, will you prepare a flock for letting the ram out and then the subsequent work that comes with it, lambing and bad weather and feeding, you know, because the decisions you make in August, September are the decisions that's going to implicate your farming life for the next 9 months ahead.
And is it getting tougher year on year to answer that question with a yes?
Well, yeah, you'd ask yourself the question, but then
what else are you going to do?
What else are you going to do? Yeah, you know, you're not going to play Scooby-Doo. Or, you know, yes, there are pluses in it, but at the same time, I haven't as many sheep as I had in the past, but every year, you know, the demand work. But yes, I'll continue, I suppose. as long as I can keep going, you know, for a while anyway. And I take every year by year.
Mm-hmm. When you hear people talking on radio or writing in newspapers about the need to get sheep off this landscape and return it to nature, oh, listen to the cuckoo.
It's there in the distance.
So you return every year?
Oh, yeah, you do, yeah. In the past, there was corncrake when you had pockets of...
Nettles and...
Well, hay, especially the corncrake. Now, there was not many sheep. Maybe they might have cattle that time, and they would have the sheep stayed in the mountain, and the cattle were in the final land. Now, it's all sheep that's down here. But they'd all probably come back. Obviously, they'd want a little bit of help from men to do it, because, you know, if they could capture these chicks and get them back, but there it goes again.
How does it make you feel to think that it's probably our impact on this landscape that has seen those species disappear?
Well, I suppose it that's a true fact. It is our impact, because the farming methods changed in the 70s. There was lots of people brought in diggers and there was rock removal. You know, it was marginal land at the best of time.
Yeah.
And there's only so much you can do with that, because it will return to nature again. The rushes will come back and the green grass will stop growing, and it'll be replaced with weeds and bushes and bramble and briars, and that's what will happen. But and that's why a lot of the species have disappeared, because...
Well, so really, the less feet trampling across us, the more favours we're doing the landscape. So are you saying that it might be time to start reducing stock around here?
Well, I think myself they'll reduce naturally.
As we let the cuckoo continue contributing to the conversation, it became clear that rather than farmers and national park ending up in conflict, that the timing of Parc na Shumta na Mara could be just about right.
It's a hard way of life because of the rainfall. You're out here in Western Ireland and high winds, and I suppose the sheep are not as tough as they were many years ago.
What's the age profile of most of you?
There are a lot of them old, in their 60s, and obviously they're looking at a get-out clause as well. You know, some of them have... There's nobody coming after them, and the way of life... that they knew is not going to continue, you know. Obviously, age takes care of that.
What are your feelings, and what's the feeling generally about the idea of the national park?
Well, personally, mine might be a subjective opinion because of the age I am, you know. But I think it has positives. But the big thing is can the local infrastructure cope? You know, the roads are narrow.
Mm.
A high percentage of walkers on the roads... A lot of caravans coming in.
Sustainable tourism, worry number one, yeah. What about the future of farming here? How do you feel about that?
Well, they'll always have, in a national park or in the surrounding lands, you'd always have to have an element of farming, because what it would do then is it would grow furs and wild grasses, and you'd have another problem. Obviously, they are highly flammable at certain time of the year. That's what happened. You see, sheep are they're destructive in one sense, but they keep... A relative balance at the same time. Okay, there was overgrazing in the past and places were eaten down
to the quick, yeah.
You'd have to have an element of grazing. You'd have to have management. You just couldn't abandon it. And
is your feeling shared by others, do you think, Brendan?
I would imagine it would. With the last two winters are severe, and all the farmers here are talking about having less numbers anyway. So
really, okay.
Yeah.
So this kind of comes at a fortuitous moment, then, doesn't
it? But obviously, they're getting direct payments, and if they disappeared in the morning, it would be just abandoned. Maybe it'll take 1 or 2 years to come back with a plan, you know. That, and then, obviously, their intention is to not to force anything on the landscape, but let everybody have their say and see what happens.
Kira, tell me the story, please, of how this park came to be ours.
So So I'm really excited to answer that question, because the idea of a marine national park has been one that has been carried through generations of the National Parks and Wildlife Service, who were never in a position to deliver it, but who kept it alive as an idea.
Kira Carberry is the person in the National Parks and Wildlife Service in charge of nature conservation.
The park is an archipelago of sites, or a group of sites, on the Dingle Peninsula, down in the area of Corcaguina and the surroundings. It's our biggest national park, it's our newest national park. It's 70,000 acres, mainly in the sea and surrounding and coastal sites. And we have wanted to put this together for a long time. It's composed of a set of sites that have been, in their own right, recognised on the European stage, recognised nationally. They've got all kinds of legal protections and designations, but we've never been able to bring them together. So the story of Park na Siúnta na Mara is in part a story that was made possible by the acquisition of new property by the state in the area, and chiefly people will have been aware of all of the rumour and excitement and final confirmation that the state had acquired the Conor Pass, the lands at the Conor Pass. We also acquired a very serious parcel of land on Mount Brandon, that's upland blanket bog and heath. We acquired the sand dune spit at Inch, which is globally significant in terms of a sand dune system, and we acquired the Owen Moore fishery, which is sort of at the foot of Mount Brandon, but right beside the Conor Pass, and is one of the most significant freshwater pearl mussel sites in the country. So bringing all of those together with the existing state properties in the area makes up the Park na Siúnta na Mara.
It is what it is right now. What do you think it could be in 30 or 40 years' time?
That's a great question, because this is a project that's going to be across generations. So this is an area of the country that has been looked after and minded by generations and generations of people. It has now been brought into the ownership of the public. If we come back in 3 or 4 generations' time, never mind in 30 or 40 years, it will still belong to Ireland, to the Irish people, to the public. And what I hope to see there is that it will have been managed in a really, really sustainable way for the protection of nature. That's the primary purpose, for the protection and conservation of nature and the sustainable use of the park. So I'd like to see that if we looked out over the Conor Pass in 30 or 40 years, the habitats on the Conor Pass, for example, would have been managed for the protection and conservation of all of the habitats and species that are special there, whether that's the peregrine falcons, whether it's the chough that are nesting there.
What though about the protection and the conservation of the people who are living there now, who are drawing a living, a livelihood from this landscape?
We're absolutely determined that the only real way to protect the park in the long term is to include and consult with and draw on the expertise and the goodwill of people living there and depending on the place.
So have you arrived with a plan, or are you shaping a plan with them?
So we will shape a nature conservation plan for Park na Siúnta na Mara in consultation with the people who live in the area, but also in wider consultation, because this is a national park. It's significant on the national stage. So there has been already a huge amount of engagement locally, but this month we will open a wider national consultation. That's the only way to do this in a sustainable way. It's the only way to do it for the long term, and it hugely strengthens and protects a place if the local community is protecting it and is benefiting from it.
Upland, open ground basically. That's the habitat that's important for and designated for, and that needs grazing.
Park na Siúnta na Mara, Kiri, is many people's work. But if there's one person who has been quietly driving the idea and keeping it alive through the austerity years when the National Parks and Wildlife Service lost much of its budget and staff, that would be Philip Buckley.
He has on it now, they seem to be suited because they're a light animal.
He brought me up a rocky Mount Brandon path to where the state already owns a large stretch of blanket bog and has just purchased more.
And that needs grazing, really. So there would have been sheep on it at one time, but then we tried one variety of cattle.
He wanted to show me an experiment that NPWS has been running with a local farmer, a project that conserves nature, manages the landscape to prevent fire, and allows locals to draw a living from the land.
It's upland heat, blanket bog, those kind of habitats, and that's why it is important, and that's why it's recognised as being of importance. And those type of habitats, in order to manage them properly, you need to have some level of grazing. Now, it might depend exactly on what that level should be, or what species it should be, sheep or what type of cattle. So we've tried one or two different breeds of cattle here. We have dextrose here at the moment, and we're managing the impact they're having on this habitat. Indeed, it's improving it.
So some people would look at this and they would say, well, hang on a second, you're still actively farming inside a national park, but your way of looking at it and saying, no, this is something of an open-air laboratory.
It is indeed. I mean, the state has made the commitment to manage this to this, you know, its maximum possibilities for wildlife. At this point in time, the type of habitats that are here are those that are considered to be most important. If we want to keep them and improve them, we have to manage them. We have to graze them. If we don't graze them, they will revert to something else. Now, there might be a much more broader philosophical question about, you know, in the really long term, whatever site you have, what type of habitats do you want in it? Do you want something that is, you know, you put the fence around it, as you say, and you leave it to its own devices? Or do you want something that is managed and you will end up with a particular type of habitat? So,
and in the short to medium term, if you were to put the fence up with, what would you end up with?
Well, I suppose in the short term, you'll probably, this habitat will change very slowly. But in the long term, what you will end up with here, maybe in the long, long term, certainly away from the edge, but you would end up with woodland of some type or other. At the minute, the habitats that are here are those which are deemed to be significant, and they are recognised as such underneath these EU directives. But that doesn't mean that when we're putting this park together and managing in the long term, we will look, I think, very deeply and see, like, what are the possibilities within an area like this. And while I expect that we will continue to manage in the immediate term and probably in the long term some of the habitats that are here in the way they are at the minute, there's also the possibility we might think of maybe increasing the amount of woodland in some areas in the really long term.
From what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I'm understanding that there's kind of three major options. One, you continue to use livestock to manage this environment, to preserve what you have here, or you put up the big fence and you walk away, or you actively intervene to try and restore woodland. Are there other options?
No, I think those three options really, one is basically keep it as it is, but keeping it as it is in to maximum possibilities. So you are, if you're going to do that, you will need to graze it with something, and you have to determine exactly what the right stocking level is and what the right animal is. So that's one option. The other option then is, I think, is, as you say, is just put a fence around some of it and leave it to its own devices. If we were going to do that, I think we would probably only do it in certain parts of this park and not over the whole lot of it, because this is a very extensive area of important heathland and blanket bog, and certainly the blanket bog in particular, I think, is a habitat that we would want to maintain in perpetuity.
Is it exciting? Are you excited?
Yeah. No, I think this is exciting. But this is a new departure. I mean, any national park is, you know, exciting, and is you know, the state making that commitment to do something to really look after it. But I think here in Páirc na Seomta na Mara Cíorcaoil, we have a mixture here which is unique in Ireland. We have not just these terrestrial or marine influenced land areas, but we have a very large area of open marine waters, and there are habitats there and species there and communities there and livelihoods there that we need to figure out and look at in a lot more detail to come to the maximum possibilities for this park. I mean, this park is a national park, primary purpose conservation of biodiversity. But if you look at this area, go back 100 years or even now, the knowledge, the cultural heritage here, the archaeological heritage, the language heritage, the people here in the Blasket Islands or adjacent to us here, I mean, they left a legacy which was nearly unique in terms of Ireland. I mean, those people, they knew this area intimately. They knew it better than anybody else, better than any scientist or better than any commentator. And they wrote about this area and their livelihoods. They wrote about it in their own words, and they told their own stories in their own language. That was at a time when most commentary or most writing about something was done by elites and powerful people. So the local people here, they left a legacy from that time in terms of literature, which is, you know, unparalleled. And likewise, the knowledge of the people here today about this land here and the farming that has gone on in it and is still going on in it, that is something we need to capture, and we need to continue and make sure we put all of that into the mix of Páirc na Seomra na Mara Cíorigh.
People are as important a part of that landscape and the idea of a national park to you as the ecology.
Absolutely. I mean, again, the primary purpose is the conservation of biodiversity, but that can't be done in isolation from the local communities. And in some ways, I suppose, if you go back to the Blasket Islanders, and if you think they were of the place and they knew it better than anybody else. And I think it was Muir Seo Suleimán in Feithe Bliainig Fáis. In the beginning of that book, he wrote, "I was born and bred on the Great Blasket, a small, truly Gaelic island off the northwest coast of Kerry, where the storms of the sky and of the wild sea beat unceasingly from one end of the year to the other and from generation to generation against the wrinkled rocks that stand above the waves that wash in and out of the coves where the seals make their homes." Now, if you could find someone who could describe this place as well as that, I'll buy you a gallon of porter.
Páirc na Seomra na Mara is, as the name suggests, mostly on or under the water. After the break, we will be heading out to sea. Ireland's newest and largest national park is the same size as about 2,000 average Irish farms. But Páirc na Seomra na Mara Cíorigh does what it says on the tin. Most of it is at sea. The Kerry Head Shoal, Blasket Sound, the waters around the Skelligs and Derrynane Bay. Vincent Hyland has spent his adult life in the waters in Derrynane, which have never ceased to provide astonishing spectacles.
We saw this boiling water come towards us. And I mean boiling, it was white foam, and it was coming at us at speed. Big, big, big fish. And they were chasing down some prey. And there were lots of gannets diving because it was huge activity. So there was minke whales everywhere. Wow. There was common dolphins around as well. So it was just this big gathering of all of this marine life. And then I just saw one tuna come up and it opened its mouth. And so big, it actually swallowed a gannet.
Oh my God.
By mistake.
And spat it back out?
It spat it out. All in an instant, yeah.
We really don't know the half of it when it comes to the sea, do we?
No, we don't. We don't. We don't. We just... You have to get underwater, haven't you? It's, you know, fine being on the water, but everybody should put on a mask and just go and look under the water immediately down from where they are.
The area is shallow. It's shallow with lots of different varieties of seaweeds. Starting with the brown and the green down to the red, but also in this environment.
5 years ago, Vinnie took me for a dive here for a TV documentary to show me the damage that trawling had done to Derrynane Bay. This time, though, I asked him to show me what Derrynane Bay had that was special and worth conserving.
And a little bit away from the shoreline, you would expect to see mackerel passing overhead, chasing sand eels. Okay, then we might see a sprat. And then as we go out onto the sand, you're coming into the area.
A woodland of seagrass beds and kelp forests. All the species that you would expect, wrasse, dogfish, mackerel, but true exotics as well. The ocean-going sunfish, dolphins, whales, turtles, even otherworldly glass eels.
When you go under the water here, you see a true representation of what it is to just let a place grow wild under the water. And that's what we saw. We saw a vast array of serrated wrack. These are all the brown seaweeds, the kelps, of course, being the bigger of those. And lots of then green sea lettuce. It's like an underwater marine forest, and that in turn is a habitat for many, many different species of small fish, of crustaceans, so, you know, the very juvenile stages of crabs. And then, of course, you'll come across small little lobsters and various animals then that actually stick themselves to the rocks, so lots of different types of sea anemones. We get quite a lot of bottlenose dolphins here. We've already had lots of basking shark around the area. And then, you know, the treat for me is the ocean sunfish, this big, 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 gorgeous looking fish, the one that the Germans call the swimming head.
You've dived in the Antarctic, you've dived in the Galapagos, some of the most special marine environments around the world. How does what we have here compare?
It's right up there.
Vincent Hyland has written a book, Wild Derry Nan, full of spectacular images about this corner of the national park that is also about the entire Irish coastline. For such a committed ecologist, though, he has a very unselfish attitude to sharing the seas with the inshore fishing fleet. Can we conserve what we have while still allowing people to draw a livelihood from the waters, or do we just need to stop all activity?
I don't think we need to stop all activity. I think it will be something of the essence where some areas will be especially protected. And what I mean by that is absolutely let go wild with no human involvement at all. And hopefully that in turn then will result in overspill, so that species outside of that or who move from that place out to the outside of it will actually be able to be exploited in a more sustainable way. Everybody gets a piece of the pie, but environments that benefit most are the wild ones.
The National Parks and Wildlife Service has told the fishermen of the area that the creation of the national park doesn't mean any immediate change to the way they do business, and that the idea of a national park is one that will be developed in conjunction with them. What's a good day? How many of those would you fill?
68 boxes, I suppose, on average, you know, at the moment. Crab.
And so that's really the only thing that you can take out of these waters right now?
Crab, lobster, crayfish, scallop. That's basically it in a nutshell.
I met Eddie Moore of the National Inshore Fishermen's Association on his boat in the harbour in Danganycleish.
With the lightning, they decided to tell the inshore fishermen that they couldn't land pollock.
Fishermen attitudes towards the national park are overshadowed by their concern about their industry. What they are allowed to fish for here has been severely curtailed in recent years and is now effectively confined to crabs and lobsters. And the price for crab on the international market has just dropped dramatically.
When we had the Chinese market, crab were making €5 a kilo.
And now?
Some guys are lucky to get 150, 170.
And are you fishing at below the cost of production at that stage?
You're fishing barely, I'd say, at the cost of survival.
So clearly it's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable, completely not sustainable with the prices the way they are.
So I'm guessing this is not the best time for your industry to be contemplating anything like a national park.
No, definitely not. I'd say the key issue that we had with regard to the national park was the scare factor came into that it was going to affect people's businesses.
Are you reassured now when they say, look, there is a public consultation process to come and nothing is going to change on the ground for you tomorrow?
Yeah, we'd be quite happy because we got assurances that anything we were doing yesterday we'll be doing tomorrow.
While you might not be against the national park, it's hard to be enthusiastic about something when your industry is on its knees.
Exactly. I suppose, Philip, the our industry is I suppose that I'm 40 plus years in this industry and it's probably the lowest point I've ever seen it.
Might a national park actually be an opportunity in that case? That if the basis on which these waters are used is going to change and we're going to place a higher value on nature, you're going to have to be compensated for that somewhere along the way.
Yeah, well, I understand where you're coming from as protectors of biodiversity outside here at the moment. I mean, you can't expect to come into an area or whatever and take somebody's livelihood completely away out of it and expect them to just say, that's fine, I'm going to pack up and walk away.
Just across from the harbour, the seafront restaurants are hopping with tourists. Tens of thousands a day at this time of year who will visit many of the environmentally fragile spots in Park na Síonta na Móra, like Inch Strand, one of the country's landmark beaches, a finger of sand and grass 5 kilometres long trying to reach across the Dingle Bay down to the next peninsula. The spit and the dunes have all been bought by the state and brought into Park na Síonta na Móra. The dunes are home to scores of different species, but it's the skylarks that are the loudest about letting you know that they think it's theirs. It sounds so beautiful, doesn't it? But you know that that's actually a horrendous turf war that's going on, isn't it? It's two neighbours shouting the foulest abuse at each other about staying off my patch.
I mean, if that's how you abuse each other, fine. That's.
Aoife Delaney is a coastal expert with National Parks and Wildlife.
So in a sand dune generally, the best place to walk is either on the beach or in the more fixed vegetation. Very close to the sea where things are really unstable and there's very little vegetation, there's tons of bare sand. You have people preventing more vegetation growing in a straight line parallel to the shore. That represents a vulnerability.
Come a storm, everything up to that line, up to that path, could be taken.
That's it. Yeah, if you have high waves and really high, strong winds, they could erode up to the point of the vegetation.
The tourist-formed paths through the dunes are, in some places, a bit like a perforated edge on a piece of paper. The next storm could cut the dune along the line of the path and sweep it all out to sea.
However, if we choose to take an active role in managing how people use sand dunes, then we can really minimise the damage. If we make sure that people maybe use one route one year to get to the beach and another route the next year.
Managed tourism.
And that's the point. I suppose we tend to think we need to manage the landscape, but in this case, I think we need to manage how we use the landscape.
So to my untrained and botanically ignorant eye, I see one species, marum grass. How many species are you counting?
I can see 10 easy without even thinking.
Oh, come on.
So that's bird foot trefoil. Well, in the middle of that bit, you have a little bit of ragwort.
What's this little blue fella down here?
That is a speedwell. This is lady's bedstraw.
And so that's within a kind of a 2 metre squared plot that you've already pointed out about 10 different species. How many would you expect to find in a healthy dune?
How long is a piece of string? You wouldn't expect to get much more than 70, I would say.
What? Really?
Including all of your mosses.
Okay.
And then you have lichen as well. Lichen are really important in sand dune. I think that we have lost some of our most stunning grasslands farther inland. And the sand dunes now represent a refuge that's really hard to replicate. But for me, what is so special about this site is that it is so natural, that the processes of erosion and accretion are occurring on a scale which is really rare in Ireland. This site alone occupies 12% of our national resource of fixed dunes. It's really significant.
Hey.
And what we get to do now is we get to showcase this. We get to show people you don't have to use land for some very intensive human activity in order for it to be valuable. We can leave land to function naturally. It'll probably be okay, and we can still enjoy it.
Here's another contribution to this debate about the idea of a national park. I am on the craggy, black-rocked north coast of Valentia Island, and I'm looking at what might otherwise be a pretty unremarkable series of indentations in the ground. But they are the footprints of what we call the tetrapod, a four-legged creature that was somewhere kind of between a crocodile and a giant salamander, about a metre long. Its back legs were a little bit bigger than its front legs, and you can see where it swished its tail as it walked up out of the water, across these rocks and back into the water again, or across these mud flats as they would have been back then, because 385 million years ago when this happened, Ireland was south of the equator. The continents weren't even aligned as they are now. But this, and this will really start to wreck your head, this is the earliest record that we have of life on Earth, or life on land, more correctly, when a vertebrate came out of the water and walked up onto the land. There is no other fossilised record anywhere else in the world that predates this one here in Kerry. And thinking about that 385 million years ago versus just the 10,000 years of human civilization has made me start thinking about geological time in a way that I have never thought about it before. So maybe that's another thing that a national park can make us do. Start looking at and thinking about the world in ways that we just don't normally ever find the time or the headspace to do. That is the sound of a puffin being amorous. And Park na Shuntan na Mara Kiri is something of a romantic getaway for this endangered species. A few miles northeast of our most iconic islands, the Skelligs, is the much less well-known Puffin Island. Managed by Birdwatch Ireland, but now included in the national park.
Well, I've a great blackback gull sitting on the grass, and again with Puffin Island in the background. Blackback gulls are one of their natural predators. They'll feed on pufflings, puffin chicks. And I've seen them take them out, mob them on the cliff's face, and I've seen them gulping them down from the water.
Do we really call them pufflings?
We do call them pufflings.
Doesn't that just make them even more adorable?
Very much so.
William Hunt is a Parks and Wildlife Conservation Officer. He brought me to see Puffin Island from the cliffs overlooking it, because it's one of those few places in the park that humans shouldn't go to unless they really need to.
Puffin Island is, it's almost two-faced in many ways. You've got a sloping green southeasterly aspect, and on the northwestern side of it is sheer, steep-sided cliffs, and there's a saddle almost demarcating the island in two, or slicing down in half.
But one half of it is not entirely unlike on Blascaide Moor, but then the other side, the cliff face, is sheer.
For sure. You're almost got Blascaide Moor and the Skelligs put together in one. Puffins are burrow-nesting seabirds. They require that kind of ground soil that they can burrow into. It's soft. They can make their burrows in a nest in. And then again, where it's located, it's got great access to good foraging grounds. The waters surrounding Puffin Island and in this part of Kerry are highly productive.
Is the fact that it's also pretty inaccessible to humans perhaps one of the reasons that it's become a preferred puffin spot?
Most seabirds will prefer island locations because there's a fewer amount of predators, there's lower amount of disturbance on them. So again, Puffin Island is very hard to access. It is very close to the mainland, to the coastline, which is one of the conservation issues that we would have with it, in terms of we need to monitor biosecurity on the island, make sure biosecurity is tight, because you have different mammalian predators who may not be native to this area can access the islands. And once they get onto the islands, they can do a lot of damage.
How significant a contribution to the conservation of this endangered species is Puffin Island?
On the coast of Kerry, we've got two or three large puffin colonies. As you rightly say, puffin are endangered, they're red listed. And between Puffin Island, Skelligvihil and Tirucht and the Blaskets. We have an internationally important component of puffin population globally. So it's an important at a global level for the breeding birds here.
So you can frame this two different ways. You could say on the one hand, if we don't conserve places like Puffin Island, we will be putting a very serious dent in the global population of puffins. But on the other hand, by looking after places like Puffin Island, we are actually helping the global population of an iconic bird.
By the very nature of Puffin Island being inaccessible, we are affording protection to that species, and affording protection at a global level, not just at a local population level. This population is interlinked with populations here and other parts of the country. And by protecting this component here, we're ensuring that there's a resilience maintained within that population at a global level.
Should we be, as Irish people, proud of the contribution that conserving places like Puffin Island makes to this species?
We should be. As a nation, we've got few enough opportunities to contribute at a global level in protection of these, at this level, this type of protection. We have a great responsibility here to look after these species and ensure that those populations are maintained going forwards into the future.
Puffin Island, making an outsized contribution to the survival of a globally endangered species. Just one of the roles of Park na Siúnta na Mar a Chiaráin, which, if it all works, will be a space for farmers and fishers, locals and tourists, as well as for nature. I hope you enjoyed this morning's programme. Until next week, take care and thank you for listening.